topic of our forum tonight is Christians and the anguish of Jews, of the Jews. And we are fortunate to have a panel of representatives here to talk to us tonight, coming from centuries-old religious traditions. Phyllis coming from the oldest tradition, coming out of the Jewish faith, Dick coming out of the Roman Catholic tradition, and Peter coming out of the Lutheran tradition, to help us look at this difficult topic of how do Christians and Jews relate to each other in our world and in our current society. And our forum tonight is triggered by at least a couple things. One is the concern that many of us feel at the rapidly escalating events that are unfolding in the Persian Gulf area. Knowing that the political realities and the complexity of that situation have their roots in centuries of struggle between the different religious faiths and ethnic groups of that region, out of which come both the Jewish tradition and the Christian tradition, as well as the Muslim tradition. We're also, however, very fortunate to have, I think, Phyllis in the village with us. We don't often have as much opportunity here at Holden to talk with Jewish people, particularly what it's like to be Jewish in a predominantly Christian society and culture, and to be able to have frank and candid conversation about that, and some of the pain that results from Christian anti-Semitism against Jewish people and the Jewish faith. So what we would like to do is begin with a few short presentations by each member of the panel. Peter is going to begin by talking a little bit of some of the roots of anti-Semitism found in the Bible, particularly in the Gospel of John. And then Dick is going to talk a little bit about Christian anti-Semitism throughout history, and touch on some of the bases of that. And Phyllis is simply talk what it feels like to be Jewish amidst this reality and with this history. And when Phyllis and I were talking earlier in the evening, she asked me to stress that she really would like to have you ask whatever you feel like you want to find out about what it is like to be Jewish in this culture and society, and to not censor your questions out of any feeling of Scandinavian politeness or whatever it is that normally holds us back, or fear. But this is a chance for some candid conversation, and Phyllis would like to be able to speak to us from that perspective as well. So with that introduction, I think I'll let Peter begin.
Well, if the way into this is candor, I think that it's good to share with you the sort of the immediate genesis of why we're here. In the teaching faculty orientation last Saturday, Phyllis mentioned that she was Jewish and talked about how she had had an extremely bitter, heartbreaking experience, really, with the Gospel of John, and wondered if I was going to touch on that in my Bible studies. And when she spoke about that experience, I thought instantly about an experience I had at the University of Chicago. One of my dearest friends was a young Jewish medical student by the name of Bob Gerwin. And I said then, and I want to repeat now, he represented to me the very best of what I understand to be Jewish piety. He was molding his life around the slogan of what does God require of you but to I always get
do
it wrong.
Justice,
do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with your God. And so we were very excited in those days about the winter visits of Paul Tillich. And Paul Tillich was preaching in Rockefeller Chapel that morning, and Bob Gerwin and I had gone together to Paul Tillich's reading of on the university campus of his volume on the Spirit. So I invited Bob to come. I waited for him at the door, but he didn't come, so I thought, well, maybe he's decided not to come. I went in, and then after the service started, he came in and sat behind me. And the gospel lesson for the day was a text from John. I don't remember which one it was. It could be the one I'm going to share with you. And I said, as I said to the group Saturday, I heard that John text for the first time through Bob Gerwin's ears, and I was terrified. I still remember the way the red went up on my neck. And really, it was almost literally hair raising. I want to come back to that at the end, but my job, I should be doing with some dispatch, is to read a section of John, and it's not typical of every section of John, but it's not atypical. And let you hear it through Bob Gerber's ears and through Phyllis's ears as I read it from the 8th chapter of John. Then I will try to do a little bit of analysis and a little bit of historical perspective on it, and then just let it simmer in our psyches. From the 8th chapter of the Gospel according to St. John, I'm going to skip some of the long passage, but it really goes from chapter 31, to the end of the chapter. Jesus then said to the Jews who had believed in him. We have to remember, as we're studying John and as we're thinking tonight, there were many, many, many Jews that belonged. The Johannine community was probably mainly Jews, particularly at the beginning. Jesus said then to the Jews who had believed in him, "If you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free." They answered him, "We are descendants of Abraham and have never been in bondage to anyone. How is it that you say you will be made free?" And then I'm skipping a section on a discussion between Jesus and the Jewish authorities on who are the real children of Abraham, descendants of Abraham. And then I'm plunging, beginning at verse 44, into the section that really is quite hair-raising in its, do I dare say, viciousness on both sides? Just see whether you think that's too strong a word. Verse 44, Jesus, the Johannine Jesus, saying to, quote, the Jews, "You are of your father the devil, and your will is to do your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning and has nothing to do with the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks according to his own nature, for he is a liar and the father of lies. But because I tell the truth, you do not believe me. Which of you convicts me of sin? If I tell the truth, why do you not believe me? He who is of God hears the words of God. The reason why you do not hear them is that you are not of God." The Jews answered him, "Are we not right in saying that you are a Samaritan and have a demon?" Jesus answered, "I have not a demon, but I honor my Father and you dishonor me. Yet I do not seek my own glory. There is one who seeks it, and he will be the judge. Truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, that one will never see death." The Jews said to him, "Now we know you have a demon. Abraham died, as did the prophets, and you say, if anyone keeps my word, he will never taste death. Are you greater than our father Abraham, who died? And the prophets died. Who do you claim to be?" Jesus answered, "If I glorify myself, my glory is nothing. It is my Father who glorifies me, of whom you say that he is your God. But you have not known him. I know him. If I said, I do not know him, I should be a liar like you. But I do know him, and I keep his word. Your father Abraham rejoiced that he was to see my day. He saw it and was glad." The Jews said to him, "You are not yet 50 years old, and you have seen Abraham?" Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am." So they took up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. By any reading, even if you understand that John's gospel is a highly stylized recasting of the Jesus drama and the Jesus tradition, by any standard, this reflects life and death struggle and controversy. And we just have to let that be in front of us. Now, how do Christians, Phyllis, get out of this? I think it's wrong for us to try to get out of everything, but I think it's also very correct and very important for this meeting to look at this historically. The title, The Jews, appears about 70 times in John's Gospel, as over again 6 or 7 times in each of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Now, some of the people, when we were talking about this, pointed out the things that they had read, that in many instances, Jews, the Jews, in John's Gospel simply means those who live in Judea. I think that works for chapters 11 and 12, but it doesn't work for the whole Gospel at all. We don't have our out there. I checked again my handy dandy 2-volume Raymond Brown commentary, and he has listed in a very scholarly way some of the explanations of this term. He makes the point, and I think it's a correct point, that for John, or the writers of John's Gospel, the Jews, was in most instances a technical term for the religious authorities, particularly those in Jerusalem, who are hostile to Jesus. And we could go through a whole series of people in the Gospel who are believers and gentlefolk, and they are all Jews. I mean, the parents of the blind man who was made to see, we've dealt with that chapter in several different ways this week, they are afraid of the Jews. That doesn't mean they were afraid of all their relatives. That meant they were afraid, and Brown's point is well taken, of the authorities, who were in the main clash and conflict with Jesus. Also in the hair-raising passage I just read. Another factor that I don't know exactly how to evaluate, that Brown points out, is that at the time of the writing of John's Gospel, which may have been between 95 and 100, those Jews who were going to believe had joined the Christian group, and the line of demarcation between the synagogue and the Christian community had become very, very clear and very, very confrontative, even mutually vicious. See, I don't know whether I should even use that term, but that was, do you remember when you listened to what I read? That's heavy stuff. That's hard stuff. Okay. Now, the other point, and we're going to talk about that in the Bible study tomorrow, that for the writer or writers of the fourth gospel, the Jews and the world, those two terms, almost technical terms, had come in the gospel to mean all those, to lump together all those who refused to come to Jesus as the light of the world. Then two quotations from Brown at this point. John is not anti-Semitic, says Raymond Brown, who's a member of your tradition. The evangelist is condemning not race nor people, but opposition to Jesus. And then he makes the same point in different words on the same page. Unlike the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, John does not attack the Pharisees or the Jews for hypocrisy or for their moral or for their social behavior, but the whole attack centers on their refusal to believe in Jesus and on their desire to kill him. Now, even if I said I wanted to do this with dispatch, I want to take enough time to say to Phyllis that one reason why I was surprised to hear the anti-Semitism bubbling up out of John's Gospel when Bob Gerwin was sitting behind me was that the preaching tradition that I came out of never say in Lent ever talked about the Jews killing Jesus. Our preaching tradition always talked about our sins being the sins that crucified Jesus. So our own preaching tradition did not help us to hear the anti-Semitism in a text like that. And it has both its good and bad side, and we can talk about that good and bad side. Mr. Moderator, I'm through.
Thank you. Dick Taylor's going to talk a little about the historical.
I think it's wonderful and it's important that we can do the kind of looking at the Gospel of John that Peter has just done. And there's been a lot of modern books and study guides and helps for liturgy that have been written to try to help us to see the very kinds of things that you've pointed out. And when you look at it, it does seem very obvious because Jesus' mother was Jewish, Jesus was Jewish, his disciples were all Jewish. I mean, to have Christians hating Jews or stereotyping Jews just seems really totally irrational. And yet, I think it's true that for most of the history of the church, this was not the way those passages were interpreted. In fact, they were interpreted as excuses for hatred and for persecution and for other kinds of horrors. And this is very difficult stuff. This is stuff that I was surprised and dismayed to find out about when I found out about it first. And I think when I say the things that I'm going to say, some of you may even say, can this be true? I have never heard this. And I would just like to kind of point you to your library here, to a number of books that I think document very completely what I'm going to say, and particularly to point you to this book by Edward Flannery, The Anguish of the Jews, from which part of the title of tonight's panel was taken. He's a Catholic historian. This is painful and difficult stuff. I'd like to take one other section from John's Gospel. Once more, Pilate went out and said to them, "Look, I'm bringing him out to you so that you may know that I find no guilt in him." So Jesus came out. When the chief priests and the guards saw him, they cried out, "Crucify him, crucify him." Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and crucify him. I find no guilt in him." The Jews answered, "We have a law, and according to that law, he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God." Pilate tried to release him, but the Jews cried out, "If you release him, you are not a friend of Caesar." Pilate said to the Jews, "Behold your king." They cried out, take him away, crucify him." Now, I mention that particular passage because it has especially been interpreted in the Christian community as holding the Jewish community responsible for deicide, being Christ killers. According to a long history of Christian interpretation, which luckily you don't hear very much today, but a long, long history of Christian interpretation, this passage and others like it was interpreted that the Jewish community were the ones responsible for killing Jesus, the Son of God, the Messiah, our Lord. They are Christ killers. And it was very easy to move from that to three other steps. Step one, if this is true, how can we have any kind of fellowship or dealing with Jews? Step number two, won't God punish them severely for having killed his son, whom he sent in love to save the world? Step number three, mightn't it be valid for us as followers of God, to be instruments of God's punishment against the Jews. Many scholars believe that the charge of deicide is the deepest root of Christian anti-Semitism and is primarily responsible for the Christian horrors against the Jews down through history. As one of these scholars said, the people of the cross have made the Jews a cross among the peoples. I'm going to speak about some of these horrors, and it's very hard to, but I think it's necessary. But I don't want to imply that there's been nothing redeeming in this relationship. Down through history, since the time of Jesus, then there have been examples of Christians, including popes, bishops, clergy, and ordinary Christian people, who have defended Jews and who have stood up for their rights. But by and large, I think most scholars would agree, the record has been much more negative than positive, and much more horrible than most of us Christians realize. Here are just a few examples, and you can look at Flannery for the whole history. Saint Justin in the second century was the first kind of major Christian leader to link deicide with the idea of just punishment. He wrote a book in which he did a dialogue with a rabbi, and he commented on the suffering that the Jews were experiencing as the result of the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. And he says, "The tribulations were justly imposed on you, for you have murdered the just one." The idea of that connection between the suffering of the Jews and their killing of Christ. Then Saint Gregory of Nyssa in the 4th century, he describes the Jews as, quotes, "slayers of the Lord, murderers of the prophets, enemies of God, haters of God, adversaries of grace, enemies of the Father's faith, advocates of the devil, brood of vipers, slanderers, scoffers, men of darkened minds, leaven of the Pharisees, congregation of demons, sinners, wicked men, stoners, and haters of goodness." This from the words of a saint.
And they're all biblical phrases.
A little bit later came St. John Chrysostom, who in some ways is one of my favorite early figures. He was a mighty preacher, he was a brilliant writer. But again, just to see some of the things that he wrote about the Jewish community. "Are they not inveterate murderers, destroyers, men possessed by the devil? Indeed, they have surpassed the ferocity of wild beasts, for they murder their offspring and immolate them to the devil. Their synagogue, not only is it a theater and a house of prostitution, but a cavern of brigands, a repair of wild beasts, a place of shame and ridicule, the domicile of the devil, as is the soul of the Jews. Why are Jews degenerate? Because of their odious assassination of Christ. This supreme crime lies at the roots of their degradation and their woes. There is no expiation possible, no indulgence, no pardon."
Which century was that?
4th century. Now, as Christians went from being a persecuted minority to being really the majority in the Roman world, and went from a persecuted community to really being the Holy Roman Empire, they had the opportunity then to implement this theology into law. And pretty early on, they forbade Christian Jewish marriages. They forbade Christians from celebrating the Passover with Jews, which apparently had been somewhat common. They barred Jews from government positions and from the army. They denied Jews the rights of asylum and so on, so that by the 5th century, Jews had been made completely second-class citizens in the Roman Empire. There was a brief interlude with St. Gregory the Great, who was both a temporal and a spiritual leader. He defended the Jews' legal rights. He intervened to prevent mistreatment. He insisted that any presentation of the gospel be done with gentleness and persuasion rather than forced baptisms, which also had become common. But after him, the theology of deicide again came to the fore, And I just want to mention some of the results that happened over the next 1,000 years. We don't have time to go into this in any detail. But remember that this is mostly a combination of Christian thinkers and Christian, at least so-called Christian rulers in their governments and what they did. In Spain, all Jewish rights were banned. Jews were reduced to slavery. All Jewish children above the age of 7 were ordered to taken away from their parents and raised by Christians. Jews were expelled from towns, whole areas, and even nations. In 1394, all Jews were ordered to leave France. Jews were forced out of agriculture, then out of most other commerce, and into money lending as the only option available to them. For one 300-year period, about the time of the United States has been in existence, the custom was that on Good Friday, in retribution for their killing of Jesus, Jews received a slap on the face from Christians. The Crusaders, before going to the Holy Land, massacred whole Jewish communities, saying that we should take care of the infidels at home before we go to take care of the infidels in the Holy Land. Synagogues were burned to the ground, often with the Jews inside. In many countries, Jews were made to wear a distinctive dress. In France, a yellow sphere called a badge of shame had to be worn by Jews. A pointed hat in Poland. In Germany, a so-called Jewish hat. Jewish sacred books were burned again and again by Christian mobs. Jews were herded into ghettos. There were pogroms and massacres that destroyed whole Jewish communities. During 1 year, 1096, from 1/4 to 1/3 of the Jewish population of Germany and northern France were killed. When the Protestant Reformation came, one would have hoped that there would have been some change in this. And indeed, I'll just mention Martin Luther, but I could have talked about Calvin or some of the others. He at first was very friendly toward the Jews, feeling that because of reform of Catholicism and getting rid of many of the corrupt practices, that the Christianity he was preaching would be attractive to Jews. But when the Jews didn't respond, Martin Luther responded in words that I will quote. Jews are poisoners, ritual murderers, usurers. They are parasites on Christian society. They are worse than devils. It is harder to convert them than Satan himself. They are doomed to hell. They are, in truth, the Antichrist. Their synagogues should be destroyed and their books seized. They should be forced to work with their hands. During his last years, Luther made repeated efforts to have the German princes oppress or expel Jews. In his last sermon, delivered a few days before his death, he called urgently for their expulsion from all Germany. And just moving kind of quickly up to Hitler and the Holocaust, one of the most scholarly writings about what happened to the Jews under Hitler is by a man named Hilberg, who wrote a book called The Destruction of the European Jews. And in that horrible book, the most horrible page in it, and I can still see it before my eyes, was one where he made two columns. On the left column was a list of the teachings and practices of Christians against Jews down through quite a number of centuries. On the right column were the edicts and practices of Hitler's Third Reich. And every single one was parallel, except for Hitler's final solution of putting Jews in the gas chambers and killing 6 million of them. Hitler did not develop the Yellow Star. Christians in France developed that. Hitler did not develop the Warsaw Ghetto. We invented that. A group of Christian leaders met with Hitler to try to protest some of the things that he was doing in the 1930s, and they were surprised that Hitler showed a real knowledge of this Christian history of persecution, and he quoted examples, and he said to them, "We're just doing better what the church has been trying to do for centuries." And in Mein Kampf, he wrote the following, "I believe that I am today acting in accordance with the will of the Almighty Creator. By defending myself against the Jew, I am fighting for the work of the Lord." can you hear in there a horrible resonance between those words of Hitler and words of many, many Christian leaders? There were some dramatic, thank God, examples of resistance to Hitler and attempts to save Jews, not the least of which were Lutheran Bishop Evan Berggrav in Norway, a Lutheran theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer in France, the Protestant Huguenots André and Magda Trocmé in France, whose community saved 5,000 Jews, King Christian in Denmark, who wore the yellow star in solidarity with the Jews that were being forced to do that. But mostly, these were isolated cases, unfortunately. Mostly, there was no objection from Christian leaders and ordinary Christian people to what Hitler was doing. And in fact, some Christian leaders, Christians mostly on the side of anti-Semitism and persecution, and with very few rays of light. And it seems to me our challenge today is to inform ourselves, to deeply repent, to re-educate all our Christian communities about what has happened so that this darkness doesn't continue into the future. And there have been some wonderful examples to get that process in motion, and a lot has happened, and maybe we can talk about some of those things in our discussion.
Thank you, Dick.
A friend of ours named Sam Goldman, who lives in New York, said to me, what is this thing with Christians? You know, I know there's somebody named Jesus. My only knowledge of Christians is there's a person named Jesus, then came the Crusades, then came the Inquisition, then came the pogroms, and then came the Holocaust. And that is all I know about Christians. And I think that's true. I think that's true for the vast majority of Jews in this country, and I think around the world as well. And when we were talking about the Iraqi situation and where is Israel in all this, my sense is that there is no way to understand the position of Israel and the position of American Jews without understanding what Peter and Dick have been talking about. Because the reality is that the Jewish community feels quite alone, no matter what, quite alone, and totally vulnerable. And it's almost as if, you know, when push comes to shove, this will happen again. I don't feel any less sure, or most Jews do not feel any less sure that people will come to our aid than I think probably Jews in the 30s. And that's a hard reality, and it's a lonely reality, and that sense of being so totally alone and being willing to be sold out, again, for political expediency, economic expediency, etc., is very, very real. And it gets reinforced all the time. And let me go back a little bit to some of my own upbringing. My grandparents emigrated here from what is now the Soviet Union, had been Belarusia, and Ukraine, and from Poland, from outside Warsaw. They came fleeing pogroms. My grandfather, who is a wonderful, wonderful man, was chased up the stairs by a Cossack ready to kill him on a horse. You know, and it was that experience that made him feel in this century that he had to get to the States, which he did steerage, and then worked sweatshops in New York to bring over relative after relative. My parents moved from Brooklyn, which is where I was born, to the home they still live in, or my mother and my stepfather still live in 1944. And at that time, there were basically signs saying no dogs and Jews allowed. I was 29 years old before I crossed this street in this one town that was the forbidden street. You know, it was that clear. I thought, okay, I'm an adult. I'm 29 years old. I can cross from one side of the road to the other. But it was such an unwritten kind of thing. And it was so fearful that you didn't cross the street. I mean, that's now. That's my growing up. When the Jewish community began moving into this town, the Christians moved to the other side of the street, set up their own schools, set up their own clubs. Everything was segregated. We had no connection at all with the Christians. I mean, it was this kind of fearful group that had said, you can't live here, you can't talk to us, you can't go to school with our kids. While that was going on, all the revelations of the Holocaust was also going on. And for a long time, the only thing I read was Holocaust literature. I mean, I would stand in front of a mirror and say, you are a Jew and you would be dead. You know, and that feeling on a gut level has carried through to particularly our son. We have a homemade child and an adopted child. And when our son, people keep saying, which is we're your own, they're both our children. One happens to be homemade, one happens to be adopted. And because Dick and I are interfaith, we had agreed that our children would be raised Quaker. And when Danny was born, he was a Jewish child. Caught me absolutely by surprise. And there was that sense, this child of mine, this child of ours, would be dead if he had been born and we had been born in a different place. And Dick has often said, when we talk about the Holocaust, you've said, well, I would be in the camps too. I would be in Auschwitz with you. And my response is, yes, you would, because you are a good Christian. You would have a choice, though, and I'd have no choice. Yeah. Debbie, our daughter, would have a choice. Danny would have no choice. And that's a very powerful kind of distinction. When we wanted to go on vacation, my parents had to get a book that listed places that would allow Jews. And one of the things I used to love to do was horseback ride. I mean, there was one place in the metropolitan New York area that would allow Jews. That was all. And we had to rely on this book to know where to go. One of the things my mother taught me early on was the expression MOT. And MOT means member of the tribe. And what would happen is we'd be in a mixed group and you know, mom would say to me, I don't think they're an MOT, which means be careful. And it has been a way of identifying when you're safe and when you're not safe. Very interesting, the last time I heard that expression was in Washington in 1987 when Dick and I were doing the nonviolent training for Peace Pentecost, and I participated in Peace Pentecost and wore a Star of David, so I wasn't totally engulfed in the Sojourner and Christian community. And during the arrest time, because I did some civil disobedience and praying for peace in front of the White House, the policeman turned to me after he had handcuffed me, and he said, you an MOT? Yeah, you too? Okay. Yeah. And there is still that sense in 1987 of a trust because we're both members of the tribe. But it's sad to me also that that designation had to be used and still has to be used. Likewise, I've had people say to me, particularly because Dick is such a devout Christian and I spend much of my life in the Christian world, I've had a number of people who found out I'm Jewish and have said, are you a completed Jew? Very common expression, but I don't think people understand that to be a Jew, I'm complete. I don't have to be complete to believe in Jesus as divine. I am all right as I am. And that expression, which seems probably a benign and an innocent question, is really an uncomfortable one. In terms of living in this country, in the hospital schedule where I work, people have a vacation day or a special day for Christmas. We don't get it for Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur. There are all these kind of constant reminders that, you know, that Dick or Dan or any of you can take off Christmas if it falls during the week. You don't have to use a personal day or vacation day. I do, if I want to practice Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah. You know, so there's always that kind of constant reminder. Two other very brief things. And one comes when I heard about St. John's Passion. I mean, Peter asked, what is that book? You know, when I hear that, what comes up? And my first reaction was, I hate John. And then I thought, well, that's not a very good feeling. I mean, I'm fearful of John, but my gut original feeling was hate because it has been used so harshly and badly. And the time that I got totally caught unaware of this was the thing that I had shared at the staff meeting. Our children went for high school, they went to public school for elementary school, and thanks to Dick's parents, they went to a Quaker school for high school. And Debbie was in the choir, so excited about performing something called St. John's Passion. I'd never heard of it. Fine. Yeah. She, you know, we worked together on developing a skirt, and she had to have a certain color belt, and I drove her to meeting for rehearsals, and it was something that dominated our house, and she was so excited and so proud. And we went to the performance of St. John's Passion, and I was enjoying the music, and then all of a sudden, the words came, you know, and the Jews cried out, "Crucify him, crucify him, the Jews, the Jews." And I lost it, and I'm going to lose it now too, because all I could do was see blood. You know, everybody else was fine. And I saw the blood of, you know, thousands of years flowing. And Debbie, after the performance, ran up and said, "Mom, wasn't it wonderful?" And she didn't find a mother that was saying, "Oh, Deb, you were great." She found a mother absolutely in tears, unable to relate to her, unable to relate to the months of work that went in, because for me, it was blood. And it was blood by Christians on us, and it was one more slap. And that's how it felt, in being able to even be joyful with my child. The last thing I wanted to share with you, because again, this is feelings, and I know, and I'm very thankful for tonight. I mean, if you weren't interested in wanting to dialogue, this wouldn't have happened. And through Dick, and through Sojourners, and through lots of people, you know, I live my life now in the Christian world, and it's been very problematic. Because I remember very clearly when I was in school, I came home to my parents and said, "I know what I want to be when I grow up." They said, "Oh, what?" I said, "A nun." True. And they had to very gently explain to me that Jewish girls don't become nuns. But that pull inside me has been very strong. We have a lot of Mary Knoll friends who are both nuns and lay missioners. We have a lot of friends who are part of the Catholic Worker Movement. I was part of a collective called Church Mouse, which really worked on simple lifestyles. And I am attracted to Jesus. And every time I have tried to look at Jesus, and every time I've thought, well, maybe, because I've had some mystical experiences that have been Jesus ones, which absolutely freaked me out. Every time I get close, I thought, but they are the enemy. How in the world can I join the enemy? And every time I think that, I pull back and I become defended again. And I say, you know, I can come and be a participant, but I'm not going to join that group. And yet there is a part of me that yearns for it, because I'm caught in two worlds now. I can no longer function fully in the Jewish world. I am clearly Jewish. I am ethnically Jewish. I am culturally Jewish. And I am a religious person. But I have found, with great pain, that I cannot be a halakhic or a ritual Jew anymore. And it's because of good Christians that I've met, and Christian lifestyle. Not so much what the church has done, but the people who have taken, for me, Christianity seriously and are willing to be crucified for it. People in this country, and people I've met in Nicaragua, and people I've met in various places. And so I am no place anymore religiously. And that is incredibly painful. And it would be lovely to say, I am home. And I can't, because the part of home is also the enemy.
Phyllis and Dick and Peter, I'm so moved by what we've heard so far tonight, it's hard to know how to even begin to respond. And I want to first just thank you all, and particularly you, Phyllis, for the depth and integrity of your sharing and your willingness to confront us and share with us both where your struggle is coming from. But we do want to take some time to hear from other people here, both your own thoughts and perspectives. If you've got questions, our panelists have said they would be more than willing to answer.
And that also stands it. I mean, no, you know, feel free to ask questions. You know, because I think most Jews don't talk honestly with Christians because it's too painful or scary. And so there are questions that, you know, I've had the privilege of asking, as a Jew, I've had the privilege of asking Christians, do you believe this? How can you believe this? Etc. But I don't think many Christians have had that option for a Jewish person who's going to answer honestly. Because I think there aren't a whole lot of honest kinds of relationships because it's too fearful. But I don't want things like saying, you know, completed Jews to make you afraid in asking questions that you might say something offensive. That's how we're going to move through it.
I have a question. Yeah. Or I just find it horrifying to know that where the Jews have gone from in the Bible being the favored community to the outcast. And where are their positions? I mean, it's not completely outcast in our church, but as the viewpoint I'm getting here, it seems very, very interesting.
When I was growing up, it seemed as if any religious group I ever came in contact with each believed they had the truth. Whether it was I had contact with, I had some friends who were Jewish. But as kids, you never talked about your religion. I mean, that just wasn't something you did. But even in the Christian community, the Catholics had the truth, the Methodists had the truth, the Lutherans had the truth, everybody. And so we all had our own areas in which we had to keep ourselves separate from everybody else. Did you feel that for yourself in growing up, Phyllis? Because I'm not sure if I can get this quite clear, but you had the truth, so you couldn't interact with other people or with the Christian community?
No.
Did you feel that at all?
Not one iota bit. No, it was the Christian community wouldn't act with us. Okay. And if you tried to venture out in the Christian community, you were liable to get slapped down. It had nothing to do with chosenness or the truth or anything else. It was really, the world was a fearful place. You know, just coming out of the Holocaust, who do you trust? You know, where were the people on the tracks? I mean, I couldn't understand why those trains rolled. Where were they? And I think that's part of what's happening now within the world Jewish community. You know, there's this tremendous resurgence of anti-Semitism in the Soviet Union. There are Jewish cemeteries in France being desecrated and a body exhumed. You might have read about that a couple months ago. You know, somebody who had just been buried, his body was taken out and staked on something in the cemetery. There are swastikas appearing, you know, in the United States, and now with the Middle East happening, and Israel getting more frightened, again, is that sense of abandonment. So it was not that chosenness, it was...
A hand here and then over here.
Following on what you said, it frightens me because I wish there were a time it was done, this persecution, and yet in Idaho, where I am from, we have the white supremacists in Northern Idaho, and a week before we left Boise, they had a situation where a Jewish home had swastikas painted on the sidewalk, and the Greek Orthodox Church did too, but they believed it was mistaken because the Jewish Education Center was right next door, but they had gotten the wrong building. This was a week ago.
Vicky?
I had a question, Phyllis, about your generation versus your son's generation. I have a lot of friends who are Jewish. I work with a lot of Jewish people. And one of the things that I've noticed is, you know, there have been a lot of shows on television about the Holocaust. And I'll come to work the next day and someone will mention it. And virtually every one of them says, I didn't watch it. I don't want to see it. And these are young people. I mean, in their probably mid-20s, early 30s. My question is, do they have the same sense that you do about their heritage and their and where they are, and how are they dealing with that? Are you following what I'm trying to say?
I think a lot of younger Jewish people don't. It's not been as real to them. And it's really very frightening. You want to assimilate. You know, you want to be part of. It's my uncle's name was A.B. Danowitz, and he changed it to A. Robert Van Dyne.
Wow. Okay.
My mother said to me, let's both get nose jobs. You know, and there was that intense sense that if you can change your name, if you can change how you look, it'll be safer. And I don't think Jewish kids now, or Jewish younger people now, have as much of that sense of fear in the gut. The Holocaust is tremendously disturbing because many people in their teens and 20s confronted with the Holocaust make the world seem, for me, it always was insecure. If you confront the Holocaust now, it becomes more insecure, and that's scary because where do you go with it? So I think you're right. I see a big difference between my feelings and our son's feelings, for example, or the feelings of his friends. But Elie Wiesel says, again, that part of our responsibility is to remember, because it is only in the remembering and the telling of the story that there is the hope that people will speak out, and that sense of abandonment, you know, won't happen again.
Jerry, you had a hand, there was one behind there too.
I'm aware of a movement called Jews for Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Would somebody on the panel like to comment on that? Mm-hmm.
Do you want to start?
Well, as Phyllis has mentioned some of her ambivalence about Jesus and some of the attractiveness of the figure of Jesus, and also of, as she said, Christians who seem to be really following Jesus. And at one point in our journey, we heard about this group, Jews for Jesus, and thought, gee, maybe there is a way to combine these two traditions, and maybe they're doing it, and maybe it would be meaningful. And so we went to a couple of meetings and talked to some people, and we were pretty appalled and pretty horrified by it. It seemed to have a very narrow theology, very, very, very conservative, mostly pretty fundamentalist, pretty much having lost the whole prophetic tradition of justice, which is so important to Judaism, and almost like having all become Protestant evangelicals of the most conservative stripe. And it had no appeal whatsoever.
It's tremendously well-funded. And also, it feels to me sneaky. There is a Jews for Jesus group and a Messianic Jewish group in Philadelphia, and they have moved into an area that's a fairly heavily Jewish area. And they became the babysitters for a lot of the Jewish families. And when the parents were out, then they did their thing. And, you know, I have a tremendous problem with proselytizing. You know, if people want to act because of their belief in Jesus, that's wonderful. And if I say, Dick, why are you acting this way? Dan, why are you acting this way? Anita, why are you acting this way? And you tell me why, I can hear that. That's wonderful. But to say, as people have said to me, you are damned, you will never go to heaven because you are a Jew, and the only way that you can be redeemed is to believe in the unique lordship of Jesus Christ, that kind of assault, which is the way it feels, just turns me off, and I can't hear then the wonderful things that people who follow Jesus do. So I find Jews for Jesus and Messianic Jews very, very problematic. One of the things in terms of something that Christians can do, and I think Dick did it, I mean, I have never met anybody who is more Jesus Christ oriented than you. I mean, it's true. I mean, it's Jesus all the time, it's Christ all the time. He doesn't use the word God, it's always Christ. And yet,
I say God down there.
Yeah, well, we'll see you
At least on Sunday.
But for somebody who believes so deeply and is so orthodoxly Christocentric at this meeting, this Messianic Jewish or Jews for Jesus meeting, when the people said, everybody who believes in Jesus, stand up. And the whole group stood up, and you had the grace, because I think you are the kind of Christian you are, to sit down with me. I did not feel alone and abandoned. And yet Jesus is the most important person or being or force in your life. And it's that kind of accompaniment that was such an important thing for me.
There are lots of hands. I'm going to try and take them in the order that I've seen them. Al, and then here, and then Heidi.
I'm interested, Phyllis, in your statement that you can't become wholeheartedly a Jew. I don't quite understand it. I'd be interested in why.
It's become clear to me only more recently, to live a Jewish lifestyle, and it's part of why it's difficult to be Jewish in this country, I would reserve Shabbos, or the Sabbath is my Friday night and Saturday, and I would do it seriously, because for me religion is serious. And that would mean, since Dick also takes Sunday as the Sabbath, we'd have no time as a couple in a family. If I were to be working in Jewish organizations, I would leave Witness for Peace, which has been so much a part of my being for a long time, and it's really been my participation initially that made it even remotely in a faith. And yet I feel extraordinarily attracted to the style of something like Witness for Peace, and not as much to the style of something like New Jewish Agenda or some of the progressive Jewish organizations. And so I found that the styles are really quite different, Christian styles and Jewish styles, in terms of interacting and meetings and stuff like that. And I've swung. I like the Christian style better. And I like the organizations I've been part of. And I like being married to Dick. And I want the time. So it's, you know, if it were different in the broader society, it might be possible to live a truly religious, in the traditional sense, Jewish lifestyle, but not anymore. And as I said to the rabbi who of the synagogue I used to be part of, that I resigned from about a month ago, very painfully. And the synagogue was the first synagogue as an adult I found that I could be part of, because it was founded as its basic principles on the combination of study, reflection, study, prayer, and action. It said from the very beginning that we recognize and affirm the right of Israel to exist and the right of the Palestinians for a homeland, the right for women to be equal in the synagogue, the right for straight, gay, and lesbian people to be full participants in the synagogue. It was a wonderful, wonderful synagogue, born out of a split of an old synagogue when the rabbi preached on Yom Kippur on the rights of the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And very, very exciting place to be part of. And yet I haven't been able to be part of it. And I told Brian, who was married, they're South African Jews who, because of their anti-apartheid work, came to the States. And when they were going to be married, we offered our home because their family was still in South Africa. So we've had a long history with Brian. And I wrote to him and said, you know, had I met you 20 years earlier, I would be an enthusiastic partner. I'm not sure we would still be married. But it's too late. It's too late for me. And that was a very sad, that was and is a very sad recognition. And I approach September and the High Holy Days with dread, because I don't know where to go.
We're nearing the end of our time, but I'd like to have these two questions get out.
I just like to say that I have a great distrust of the Lutheran Church at least. I find that it's materialistic, it's non-spiritual, it has a hard time being compassionate, and I think that for Christians within the Christian Church, it's not always easy. I find that our church has been a very growing church, but spiritually it's dead. It does nothing. You might as well throw it out some of their, you know, anywhere. So I think your feeling is not unwarranted. And I think that probably there would be a fair number of Christians within the Christian community who feel very much like you do. And when you try and talk about issues, you have no response. And I think that that's, to my mind, what hard-heartedness is. It's the inability to respond. Now, not everybody is called to respond all the time. If you can't respond to the people around you, then you got to start the problem. And I think that your position is not unreasonable, even within the Christian church. And it's probably responsible for all these other reactions that have led to anti-Semitism and all these other things.
Heidi?
This is difficult for me to say, but I come from a family that I believe is quite anti-Semitic, and I was raised a Catholic, and I don't ever remember that anti-Semitism coming from what Dick had said about Christ killing. That was never part of our tradition. It was never the way that I understood the Passion. But I really sense it's much more of a racial prejudice. And I was intrigued by what you said, Phyllis, about member of the tribe, MOT. Mm-hmm. Because I have heard Jews use that. And I have to say that as a Christian, it made that I also feel left out in that. And I sense I'm probably not saying this very well, but I sense that that is a racial thing as well, that a member of the tribe has to do with some sort of ethnicity that goes beyond purely religious.
Judaism, I appreciate you saying that, Hannah. Judaism is very difficult for people who are not Jewish to understand, because it is not, I know atheist Jews, I know pantheistic Jews, and they are still Jews, because it is a people that has, and I think in the Soviet Union we saw this, we met with...